Thank you for joining me. I am Brett Kelly, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, go ahead and follow the podcast on Twitter at Fisheries Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or you can show your support for the show on patreon.com/fisheriespodcast, along with Ben, Tyler, Janet, Robert, and John. We really appreciate your support through that means, but if you're interested in showing off your support a different way, or maybe showing off a favorite fish species on a t-shirt, go check out our merch over at the Fisheries Podcast Fan Shop, hosted by Teespring, where you can find shirts, hats, stickers, hoodies, and much more. So look for all those links in today's show notes, and that should get you set up. But as far as today, I'm super excited to chat with Dr. Shannon White. Shannon is a postdoctoral researcher at the U.S. Geological Survey's Lee Town Science Center Aquatic Ecology Branch, where she works on the conservation genetics of fishes of conservation concern. Prior to joining USGS, she earned a PhD in ecology from Penn State University, a Master of Science in Fisheries and Wildlife Science from Virginia Tech, and a Bachelor's of Science from Randolph-Macon College. Shannon is an eco-evolutionary ecologist and spends much of her time researching the linkages between genetics, individual variation, and population demography in an effort to improve native fish conservation. And without any further ado, welcome to the Fisheries Podcast, Shannon.
Thanks, Brett. It's great to be here.
So between your previous degrees and jobs, it seems like the Northeastern United States are where you like to be and do your work. Is this also where you grew up, or is this somewhere where you were inspired to work in and go to school?
Yeah, so I grew up in Central Virginia, just a few miles north of Richmond. And, you know, I wouldn't say that there's necessarily a reason I've stayed here per se, more like opportunities just kept presenting themselves. So I went to undergrad maybe a mile from my hometown, and then got kind of a great offer to go to Virginia Tech. So that was only about 3 hours away. And then, you know, I got a struck gold again when I got offered a position at Penn State. So I enjoy the New England area, the East Coast. A lot of my research interests really lie in this area. So I've just been fortunate or lucky that I've been able to just stay in this region as well.
Nice. So I guess outside of your research, is there anything else about the region that keeps you captivated? I've experienced it firsthand a couple of times, but I hear the Virginia area in the fall is one of the most sort of breathtaking scenes with fall colors. So anything like that that really keeps you captivated out there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I would love to eventually maybe get towards the West Coast. You know, it's a kind of a different atmosphere out there, a lot of great, gorgeous scenery. But I think on the East Coast, everything's just so close. I don't know. You know, major cities are pretty close, but you can get in the mountains pretty easy. The beaches are pretty close. You know, a couple hours away from anything. So I think the ease of finding different things to do maybe keeps me in the region, but certainly I think research so far has been a pretty big driver of why I've stayed here.
I hear that. I know my parents are coming out to visit Idaho soon after hopefully some things with travel settle down and blow over, but they were like, well, we're trying to keep it close to home. And I was like, oh, you know, I don't care. It's pretty common to drive 4 or 5 hours to get to where you want to be out here type of deal. So
yeah, not on the East Coast. It's so close.
Right. So you're currently employed at the USGS Lee Town Science Center, where you are working on conservation genetics. What are some of the species of conservation concern that you all are interested in?
Yeah, so we do a little bit of work on brook trout. There's a handful of projects that we have going on with native trout, specifically brook trout in this area. Actually, most of my work so far has been on Atlantic sturgeon. We just wrapped up a handful of projects that were looking at the population genetics and some mixed stock analyses for Atlantic sturgeon, which that's kind of a broad distribution from about Florida all the way into Canada. You know, that's kind of where my focus has been. I think I'm kind of new to the position. I only started a few months ago. So as we're kind of checking some boxes and getting some projects cleared away, I'm starting to try to find some footing in some other projects, things that might include potentially some non-fishes. So maybe some beetles or something like that. But I'm kind of just seeing where the research takes me there right now.
Cool. Well, congrats on the new position. I can attest to the difficulty in finding a job during that 2020 era. I graduated late summer of last year, and so it's always nice to be employed. So congratulations.
Thank you.
And are any of these species federally listed or, you know, of higher concern? I know I worked on a few species in Iowa that were state listed, but few of them were listed at a higher level. But out here, I guess it's a new experience to me to be working on a population of steelhead that are actually ESA listed, which is a lot more paperwork. But what about you?
Yeah, the ESA process, a little interesting there. So yeah, the Atlantic sturgeon, they are on the Endangered Species Act, and most of the populations would fall into that endangered category, with a couple others being listed as threatened. So in terms of federally listed, they're probably the ones that I'm working on right now that have the most conservation concern. You know, brook trout, they aren't federally listed, but most states do view them as a species of conservation concern. So there's a good bit of buy-in from most states from the research we're doing there. And then I would say quite a few of the other species we work on, I didn't mention that I do a little bit of work on flathead catfish. Those are actually invasive, so they're not listed, and we, you know, try to get out as fast as we can. So it's kind of interesting to go between a, you know, federally listed endangered species to the species that we don't care, well, not that we don't care about, but that we see it potentially being a problem in the near future and are trying to think of ways to mitigate its spread.
For sure. Well, that's pretty cool that you'll have your hands in projects that kind of span, like you said, from invasive all the way to endangered. So mm-hmm. Looks like you'll be doing some cool research while you're there. So
hopefully, yeah.
Well, one thing I've heard, and maybe you won't know quite yet, but I'm sure you'll have an idea for what work lies ahead, but is that folks don't tend to, you know, be able to get out in the field and do as much field work as their research sort of advances and their jobs. But do you think you'll still be able to get out and about and play around in the water and maybe do some fish sampling while you're at your new job?
Yeah, you know, I hope so. The cool thing about my position right now is that I am also remote. And so I still live in Pennsylvania, despite the fact that Leetown is actually in West Virginia. So I'm still living in State College, and I still have a lot of ties here to the sampling crews that are doing a couple of different projects like the Flathead Catfish Project. So there's definitely some opportunities I have to get into the field. They are definitely decreasing more and more, I think, every year. You know, on one side, it's definitely kind of sad that I'm not out playing in the streams as much as I used to, because obviously that's a big reason that I got interested in this career. On the flip side, it is really nice not to have to plan all of that work. You know, I still do a little bit of it, but it's not weekly, you know, loading the truck up and making sure the weather is looking good and kind of the hassle of going into the field. So when I do join a field crew, it tends to be spotty here and there, more as like an assistant role, which I kind of am okay with. It's a little bit less stressful than having to be the one managing it and making sure it happens. That said, it would be great to have some more field projects in the near future, especially on these nice brook trout streams that I'm used to working on. So I think that in the future I can find those where they, some opportunities where they could exist, but it's definitely less and less for sure.
Yeah, I can see that being kind of nice. You know, you don't have to worry about, oh, do we have all the anodes that we need? Or
yeah,
you drive halfway to the site and you forget that you have dip nets or shocker batteries.
Yeah, I forgot to charge the batteries. Oh, no.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that you guys did that. I'm just speaking from personal experience, unfortunately.
So everyone has done it before, right?
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, you know, this is a pretty, I wouldn't say hot button, but it's a really popular technique in the, you know, conservation field, ever more so as you go to conferences and whatnot, you'll see presentations or, you know, papers that are coming out. But do you guys think you'll ever use any eDNA techniques for your sampling that you guys have going on down at Leetown?
Yeah, it is definitely a hot button issue right now. You know, I think that there's definitely a time and place for eDNA, and there's a couple brook trout projects that I think are starting to get off the ground running that are looking at using eDNA as kind of an initial screening tool to decide if more extensive sampling with backpack electrofishing is necessary. For us personally, we don't use it, at least I haven't used it yet, because most, for the most part, we know the trout are there, and we don't really need to, you know, it's more of like a presence-absence tool, and if we know they're there, then it's not really going to do that much for us. I do think that it has some really interesting potential with some more cryptic species or some rare species that are in these smaller streams, where you might be able to detect their presence more so than, you know, for example, like a sturgeon in a really, really big river. That sample might be a little bit too diluted for eDNA to work. So I guess kind of the short answer to your question is I haven't used it personally. I know that several people are, they're getting great success with it. But we're still kind of doing tried and true fin clips for most of our population genetics work. And then some of the other genetics work we do, we actually need tissue samples, so gills and blood samples from fish.
I gotcha. Yeah, and that definitely makes sense. I mean, if it doesn't necessarily meet the study requirements, then I could see where, you know, using it is cool, but like you said, right study question, right systems. So I guess I originally heard of your research while you were at Penn State earning your PhD and studying all things brook trout through your blog, The Trout Look. It was always something that I periodically checked in on. It was always nice to know other fellow brook trout researchers. And so in your words, I suppose, what do you think the main focus of your research was while at Penn State?
That's an interesting question. And I say that because when I started at Penn State, and my advisor, Ty Wagner, is probably going to kill me if he hears this. We had no idea what I was going to do. It's great when you start a project and you have some clear objectives, and some things might shift around a little bit. But, you know, there's still a very clear direction you're going in. And I would say it wasn't until at least halfway through my PhD where there was maybe a clear direction. And in the end, I think there was some really cool studies that came out of it, and they do kind of get boiled down into a couple major themes. But I always laugh when people ask me this question because it's not so clear cut. But that being said, I would say the main focus of my research at Penn State was looking at sources of variation in a population. So you said in the intro, I'm really interested in individual variation in fishes, and that's very true. And that's definitely a focus of mine that I got really interested in while trying to figure out what the objectives of my dissertation were going to be at Penn State. And so a lot of the big studies that we did, we were looking at genetic variation among populations within a watershed, and then seeing how potentially hatchery stocking could influence that individual or that genetic variation among those populations. And then we did things that looked at maybe movement differences among fish and how those differences in movement create these large scale effects at population or metapopulation levels. So it was really trying to figure out, I guess, what the significance is, the conservation significance of individual fish, really. Because, you know, I think we often think about conserving a population or a species. And I really wanted to drag that down and say, well, no, like every individual fish can be different. What causes that variation? And is it worth us trying to conserve something that is that small, I guess?
For sure. Now that's awesome. Because exactly like you said, typically research is a little bit more zoomed out and looking at populations or, you know, even individual, just like watersheds at a time where, as you said, earlier, you know, maybe we know, you know, this fish is here, so we'll aggregate some variables and do modeling in that sense, or try and do watershed, you know, management plans and things like that. So you zoomed all the way in, which is really neat. So it might be kind of difficult to distill an entire dissertation into, you know, answering a couple of questions on the podcast. But, you know, if you had to do like a few takeaway points, maybe even like a headliner from each chapter or something, you know, mm-hmm. what were some of the most significant things that you all found through your work?
So I guess kind of even just going back to the question I just posed, you know, is individual variation important? And I think certainly every system can be different, but what we're finding increasingly so, and what I found is a really major takeaway of my research, is that individual fish are they behave very different from one another, and understanding that variation is pretty critical to potentially conserving populations or subpopulations, metapopulations of brook trout. And the evidence I have to support that is what we found. We did a radio telemetry study of brook trout, of wild brook trout. And we found, we were looking at movement, looking to see how individual fish move both in summer and then in winter. And one of the takeaway messages from that was that we didn't see that many fish that moved, which was a little surprising, though I kind of knew that going into it. Brook trout, they are a somewhat mobile species of stream trout. However, at the same time, I, you know, background literature says that you're going to see a lot of fish that don't move that much. However, what we found was it was about 20% of the population did move. And so that's really a minority of individuals that moved. But what we found is that those fish that moved, they were moving pretty large distances. And then, yeah, so they would move. We didn't track them until, you know, their last day on Earth. But what we found is that within a 24, 48 hour time span, we would see fish that were moving several, maybe, I think our largest fish moved maybe 10 kilometers.
Wow.
And really, really quickly. So it was like immediately post-spawn, these fish would take off, they would move into this really big river system, which I'll get back to. And then, so that was kind of one chapter. Fish move, some more than others, but knowing that a few fish move really far is really, really important. And the fact that these movements, they're not constant. We tracked these fish for 8 months, and literally I could go back, it was with telemetry, so I could go back to the same rock every single day and locate the same fish for like 6 months. It was
wow.
So monotonous, right? But then one day, this fish took off, and it was like, okay, well, they went to this big river system. So knowing that it's a minority of fish that move and that these movements can occur really quickly was really important. So that was, like I said, kind of one chapter. So then the other chapter is like, well, okay, we know these fish move, but why is it kind of ecologically important? So we did some modeling using some genetics modeling, actually, to try to figure out where these fish are moving to, with the idea that if fish are moving into other tributaries, then they would probably have higher genetic connectivity because they would move in and then spawn in subsequent years in another tributary. And so we created a new model for riverscape genetics, just to, again, model where across the entire watershed do these fish seem to move the most. And so, sure enough, we found that these fish, when they move around, they do seem to increase genetic connectivity across really, well, fairly large spatial scales. Really large for brook trout, but obviously it's species dependent. So yeah, these fish, it's not that many fish that move, but when they do move, they are maintaining connectivity at really large scales relative to brook trout. So, you know, that's another chapter that we did, was this idea of riverscape genetics. And I think, you know, the really cool thing to me is the story that comes out where, again, it's the individual variation that's maintaining population connectivity at really large scales. And the thing I didn't yet mention is that the main movement corridor here is a fairly large river. This river is thermally unsuitable for brook trout basically all summer. So usually when we see large river, kind of high stream temps, we don't think about that as being brook trout habitat. But it turns out that that was like an insane movement corridor for these fish. So it's not year-round brook trout habitat for sure, but it might be some of the most important brook trout habitat if we're thinking about how to naturally maintain connectivity across all of these populations. So it's wow. Think about, you know, with climate change and changes in the hydrology of these bigger river systems, then you start kind of getting a little bit nervous about, okay, well, how much longer can this really maintain as viable brook trout habitat if they need to use it for a few months out of the year and if it becomes increasingly less suitable? So it gets kind of scary, right? Because eventually what you might do is think about, the loss of a behavior really that is maintaining connectivity throughout the watershed. So that's like one of my favorite things to talk about is potentially how these cryptic, what I call cryptic phenotypes, are kind of doing some of our job for us, right? They're maintaining the connectivity that we so desperately need in these systems, but we don't even know it's there half the time because it's lucky that we did this telemetry study and we found the results that we did and we had the ability to do the genetics. And, you know, think about it, this PhD project was random to some extent, right? We had no idea we would study the system or these projects, but we did, and we found out all of this crazy cool stuff. Think about all of the other watersheds out there that might have a very similar system that's going on that we just don't know about.
Right. Yeah, my mind is like racing because I know the Iowa DNR, when I was coming to a close doing my master's research, they were starting to do some telemetry work on brook trout and found that they were, you know, highly sedentary, almost exactly like you said. They'd come right back to the same bank or pool and be like, yep, this is da 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 tag number. But it is super interesting because one of the last streams that I sampled had a very small spring inlet into it, and we found juvenile brook trout in there. And granted, it was only a couple, but the main stem of that same body of river was only a few inches deep and primarily much of the habitat, like 6 inches deep, extremely sandy, warm water fish community. And it's just a head scratcher, you know? You're like, you start looking at it on a map. The closest stream that has, you know, a healthy population of brook trout is quite far. And then you start looking at it, and you're only about a mile from the Mississippi River. And you're just like, how did this fish get here? So I definitely am going to have to sit down one day and dig into your dissertation. That sounds pretty amazing. But I guess for the sake of keeping the podcast on track for our listeners, I unfortunately have to move on to another question. But so we're genetic sampling and analyses, the tools that you used to conduct your PhD work, were they familiar to you prior to your research at Penn State?
That's another funny question. Absolutely not at all. I actually, I was super resistant to learning about genetics. Throughout my entire college, master's, everything, I'm very visual, and so genetics isn't necessarily something you can see, right? Like, especially in the lab when you're doing all of the extractions and stuff like that. I'm a complete klutz in the lab and will break everything. But on top of it, I was always, like, I did a little bit of the lab work, but thankfully we had a collaboration with Fish and Wildlife Service, and they helped us a lot on this project. But thankfully they were willing to be like, maybe you shouldn't be in the lab. Because I was always like super nervous that whatever I was doing was definitely not working, and it did work. It seems like magic to me, but anyway, genetics were not on my radar at all, but the way that my PhD actually kicked off was that we had a collaborator who was already working in the watershed, the Loyal Sack Creek watershed. And they said, you know, we've been working on brook trout for a while here. We're willing to give you some money if you would come do a fairly simple population genetics analysis of, 20, 30 sites throughout the watershed. And, not having any money for this research at the time, and also having just a very much like, I will figure it out. I will do whatever it takes to answer the question. Kind of like a go-getter attitude. I just figured it out along the way with a lot of help for some collaborators, and have been piecing together throughout the years how to do this. Nice. And I think it's working out. So far, so good, right?
Oh, I would say so, yeah. I think the things that you guys have been able to discover, and particularly on brook trout, I'm super interested in, so I know others will be as well. So kudos to you for picking it up and, you know, taking the ball and running with it, as they say.
Thanks.
So, you know, brook trout are a pretty famous and beloved species by researchers and maybe anglers alike for, you know, various reasons, like their colors or some of the places that you have to go to find them. But is there anything that makes them particularly special to you now that you've, you know, found out all these unique things about their movement or individual variation?
So the thing about me is I never really thought I would go into fisheries biology. As a undergrad first year, I never imagined I would be doing anything environmental conservation related. But my undergraduate advisor he's a trout biologist, and he had a summer research opportunity working on brook trout in Virginia. So I guess for me, you know, one of the things that just makes them really special to me is it's kind of like a nostalgia. It was my first fish that I ever really worked on. It's the fish that I really decided I wanted, or it's the fish I was studying when I decided, you know, hey, this fisheries biology thing, I think it's for me. So from like a personal standpoint, I think that it's a fish that's always going to have a pretty big piece of my heart, actually. Not a little piece, pretty big. But also,
that's awesome.
Yeah, also I think that they're kind of an underrated, I guess stream salmonids in general, are an underrated species in terms of just how many things you can study with them. So when I was an undergrad, what I was studying had much more to do with like the cognitive science of brook trout and their behavior and how they interact with one another and how they learn certain feeding behaviors and things like that. So when I started studying brook trout, to me, it was this species that was just very, I don't know, like charismatic among each other. And they had these really cool social dynamics. And I was thinking like, okay, well, brook trout are cool and all, but I think that they're just really cool because they fight. So I was interested in them because we were interested in fighting. And it was just a really cool idea that this is a species that just fights in the wild. And we camped out for summers at a time just watching fish swim around and fight each other, literally. And it wasn't until probably, I don't know when I started to realize, oh, hey, this is actually a fish that has a lot of other issues going, you know, with climate change. And it has interest from, from a recreational standpoint, from conservation standpoint, from basically any standpoint you want to look at it. If you have a question, you can study it with brook trout. Scientifically too, I think it's just really great because I have a pretty diverse interest in terms of my research. And I think that it is just a species that it's like, if you want to study it, you can probably do it in brook trout.
Very cool. That's a great answer. And that is neat that it was, you know, you got your start in yeah, fisheries. And moving off of that, it sort of has started with brook trout, and you know that's still one of your species of concerns that you're gonna work with now, but there was some other material in the middle, and your thesis work at Virginia Tech on clenched ace was also research that I found really interesting, because in some of the study systems I was looking at in northeastern Iowa, in addition to our native brook trout, we also have introduced brown trout. And so my second chapter tried to address or investigate the potential negative effects of brown trout on one of our native cyprinids, the southern red-bellied dace. And one thing I was looking at is environmental relationships, kind of habitat specific. But given that both species are, you know, pretty closely related, that's how I came across your work, doing a literature review. And could you maybe talk about what study questions you addressed while earning your master's degree?
Yeah, that's an interesting, you know, science 6 degrees of separation there, that both of us are on this salmonid chrysomys pitch here.
Exactly. Yeah, like, this is cool.
Yeah. Yeah, so my master's was also a little bit similar in the idea that we didn't have super well-defined objectives when I started it. Clinch dace is a species that is currently undescribed. And when I started my master's, there was really, really little information available on really basic ecology and life history of that species. So when I started, I think the project was funded to look at and describe some of the reproductive behavior, because clinch dace, they do exist primarily in watersheds that are impacted by mining, coal mining specifically. And so I think that there was maybe some concern or at least interest in trying to investigate what their reproductive behavior is like, because if, you know, some watershed activities are potentially influencing reproduction, then obviously we need to stop that. So that was one half of it, but very quickly we learned, well, we don't even really know where clinch dace are. They're super rare, and there was a couple streams in far southwest Virginia where we knew they probably were, but at the same time, it, you know, the sampling to date hadn't been super rigorous, and so we were like, well, first of all, I think we need to figure out where they are, then we can study reproductive behavior. And then somewhere along the way, again, it was like, well, we've never really described what they look like. And since I was out in the field, and I mean, there was pictures, and we knew the closest relative to clinch dace, but in terms of, you know, basic ichthyology, in terms, you know, counting fin rays and scales and all that other stuff, nobody had done that yet. And so I just think I was a prime candidate, given that I was in the field and I was surveying for this fish. And it was no reason, once I was collecting them, not to do some collections of them as well. So I brought some back into the lab and then did some of those morphometric and meristic counts, so that we could at least get an idea if morphologically they were different than their sister species, which I showed they were quite different. So now it's still an undescribed species, but we do know that at least morphometrically they seem to be different than their sister species. And then we, like I said, we know a little bit more about their breeding behavior. It's still a really rare fish, so I'm not, definitely not going to claim that, like, I described they're all there is about clinch dace. I really haven't. And there were some follow-up studies by some other master's students at Virginia Tech as well that have continued to learn more and more about clinch dace. So, you know, I think big picture, it was one of the first studies that did a pretty big dive into, like, let's just figure out everything about the ecology of this species, because if we're going to try to list it or conserve it or anything, we just need to know more. And so that was kind of what my master's was all about.
That's great. And is there, you know, a push to, you know, describe clinch dace and potentially list it? Or is that something that's in the works, or just more research is needed at this point?
You know, I think not being super up to date on the current status, I think that it would be hard pressed not to notice that this fish is definitely in trouble. They only exist in a handful of streams. And when they do tend to exist in fairly low abundance. So at the state level, Virginia has recognized it as a fairly high conservation need. I think the missing link is a formal description for clinch dace before it could potentially get some sort of federal listing. But whether that's in the works or even something that people want to pursue at this point is a little bit unclear to me, I guess.
Right.
Yeah. I think that it's definitely warranted, but with certain federal listings, I think it becomes harder to do conservation sometimes. And I don't know if this might fall into one of those categories. I think that right now there's just too many uncertainties though.
Nice. And if folks are interested, like you said, I know there's some other people working on clinch days, so definitely search around on the Google machine, and there's some pretty cool papers that Don Orth and others have looked at. So,
yep.
So SciComm is something that I guess I find particularly important, which probably explains why I have some involvement with the podcast. And knowing your role in the Troutlook, I'm curious, how did that blog begin? Was that your brainchild or maybe Dr. Wagner's?
Let's think. So I think what happened, so when I was doing my field work for my PhD, I was really fortunate that there was a lot of people that lived in the watershed that just really wanted to help. And so I didn't have a lot of funding, and that could have really created a lot of issues, especially for a pretty large scale telemetry project where sometimes you just need a lot of hands to help you do the work. And I was really fortunate that people that lived in the watershed that were just really invested in stream conservation, they were just willing to volunteer a ton of time to come help me. So I think I was sitting one night in during field work and thinking about, you know, how was it that I could potentially update these volunteers about what's going on with the project, or if I needed more help or anything like that. And at the same time, the people that were coming to help, a lot of them were just always curious to pick my brain about fish. And I think that a lot of them viewed it as like a really great opportunity to just learn all of the science that you and I and the fishery scientists out there get kind of the privilege of having, right? So it's the ability to read papers and to digest all this information. And we don't really think about it as like a true, fortune sometimes, but it is to a lot of people. And so, you know, between them clearly wanting information and people in general, I think the angling community, the conservation community just really wants information. And also people that I could tell sometimes were really passionate about conservation, but sometimes just weren't getting the facts right. So I was like, well, somewhere science is kind of failing people if they want to do what's right, but don't know what's right or don't have the information to evaluate the different options, then we're kind of failing them. And so all of these ideas were swirling around in my mind. And I think I got back from a field outing and I was talking to Ty about it, and he was super supportive and helped, you know, fund the website and help it get rolling and get running. So I don't know if that it was any one specific person's brainchild or not. It was more like I run it and I took on the responsibility of it and designed it and everything like that. But I don't think it would have been so successful had Ty not really pushed for it as well.
Like many things successful, there is a team behind it.
Absolutely.
But I love your, you know, inspiration or motivation to start that, because I see that lots of times too. And one of the biggest thing that I am passionate about is science accessibility, and then also science being transparent to the public.
Yeah.
So that,
absolutely,
you know, yes, we're doing this work. You might see us, you know, driving, you know, our state trucks, or at the time it was Iowa State, you know, the university vehicle all over northeastern Iowa, parked and have the, you know, Ghostbusters backpack on down in the stream. You're like, what the heck are they doing, you know?
Yeah.
And so just like letting people know exactly what you're doing, I feel a lot of times can take away from distrust, and some folks get really interested that you would have written off as never being interested in stuff like this. So I love the blog, obviously, and I think it's a great motivation. And do you still plan on writing some articles from time to time?
No, I mean, the goal was always to make it kind of a long-term thing and to hopefully or potentially recruit some people into the blog to make it more of a consistent posting. And I kind of failed on that part, but I am hoping to continue writing some articles on it. I haven't been super diligent about that in the last few months, at least, partially because I don't always work on Brooktrout now. But I do plan to keep running, to keep it going. And I think if nothing else, what I've found is that people continue to send me messages through the website, which so I know that people are still accessing it and digesting the information. And I think one of the reasons I really want to keep it going is the idea that it gives you a face to the science. I mean, my face isn't really on the website per se, but I know a lot of people have said that they appreciate that, you know, it seems like there's a person out there that's doing this work, right? It's not just science, but there's these people that are involved in the process. And so it's given people an outlet to access one of those people and to ask questions from those people. And, you know, I'm always down to talk trout and to sometimes make people think about things that might muddy the water a little bit. And so if nothing else, I think I want to keep it going to maintain kind of what you were saying, like there's a transparency in science and I want to help you, you know, digest the issues that are out there.
Was maybe one of the posts that muddied the waters and you got some feedback on when you talked about the difference between wild and native?
It was, in fact.
That one, I
knew what I was doing when I did that.
Right.
And I'm not upset that I did it. I don't regret doing it at all. I think it makes people think about it. Right. And I know some people wholeheartedly agree with that one. And then other people, don't necessarily, and that's fine too. Another reason I created the blog too is to just give people the information that they need to make informed decisions. And I'm always the proponent that I might not agree with your viewpoint, but as long as it's a viewpoint that's founded in information, then I'm not going to necessarily try to change your mind. I mean, all of this out there, it's kind of a values-based system. So if we have different values, then that's fine. I just want you to have all the information when you're making those values.
Well, that's awesome. And for those that might not know what I'm talking about, well, you're just going to have to go over to the Trout Look. So follow the link in today's show notes and find out for yourself and look at all the other awesome information. So I guess we've arrived at the point in the interview where I kind of want to ask you maybe a more deep or a philosophical question maybe, but as an eco-evolutionary ecologist that spends the majority of your time researching the linkages among genetics, individual variation, and population demography in an effort to improve native fish conservation, what is one of your biggest aspirations or goals as a fishery scientist moving forward?
Yeah, that one's a deep one, right? yeah, so I think that a lot of my research has foundations in kind of like a theoretical ecology. You know, there's all this idea of like individual variation and genetic variation. And I think that that conversation can get pretty esoteric really quickly. And I really enjoy going that theoretical route. And you know, when I write proposals and I think about my research program, I think that a lot of it is somewhat theoretical. At the same time, if you said, like, what are your biggest goals? It's to work with state managers and conservationists and people out there in the thick of it to improve conservation. And you know, sometimes that's making sure that the tools and technologies that are available to us right now are being applied and used correctly. But what I'm thinking about is, you know, what's the next step? What is the future looking like? And, you know, we have all of these models out there that are predicting, you know, the future of cold water fish. And it's pretty bleak for a lot of populations out there. And we know that climate change is coming, and we know that land use change is coming. What can we do to prepare today's populations for that future we're predicting? And so what my biggest goal is to kind of be part of that forward migration in conservation and management, and maybe not necessarily think about restoring our populations to what we had 100 years ago, but making sure that the populations we have now, or adding populations to our current numbers, what are we doing to those populations to prepare them for that future that we know is coming? So that's my goal, is to be part of that forward momentum in fisheries management and conservation.
Right on. Well, if that doesn't get you fired up as a fellow, you know, fish conservationist, then I don't know what will. So that was a great answer. And based on, you know, the determination and grit you've shown in earning your degrees and having to find money and help where it can be found, I'd say you will achieve that goal. So
we're all in this together, right? Everybody's working towards it, but
absolutely. Well, I guess what we call the tough part of the interview is now over. You can breathe a big breath of relief. And it's on to a final set of questions that we ask each of our guests. And we start simple, but some people say that this is the hardest question on the episode to answer. What is your favorite fish?
You know, I'm going to be super boring and just say it has to be brook trout. Yeah, I would love to say that I have, you know, the secret passion for a marine species or some other freshwater species. And I'm sure that many of them are just as amazing as brook trout. But based on everything I said earlier about having the personal connection plus the cool behaviors and the individual variation, I have to go with brook trout. Plus they're pretty, right? They're just a gorgeous fish.
You got to go with brook trout.
Yeah, I've got too much art hanging around my office and my house to say otherwise at this point. So
that's awesome. Well, do you have a dream job or maybe even a location? I know we spoke earlier about, you know, northeastern United States, but is there anywhere else that you'd maybe like to live or something you'd like to do?
You know, I really have enjoyed, I have a limited amount of time working at Leetown Science Center, but before that at Penn State, I was part of the USGS Cooperative Fish and Wildlife Research Unit. So I really do enjoy working kind of in the federal system, especially with USGS, a job that keeps me really research focused and really focused on the science is kind of where I ideally want to land. You know, but academia is certainly on the horizon as well, potentially. In terms of location, you know, if I get out of the eastern United States, then brook trout stop becoming native. So I would really have to assess if I want to study non-native brook trout or potentially native salmonids elsewhere. And that's certainly not out of the question. I think there's a lot of really cool studies in non-native brook trout territory as well. And you can eat them if you do that. So that's great.
There you go.
I do think in terms of dream location, I think that one thing that, you know, COVID has really taught me is that in terms of a dream job or location, I think a lot of that's going to be dictated by working with people. And so if I want to, my dream job, wherever it happens to be, is just working in a collaborative environment that I really enjoy. So if that's something like this, where we're collaborating remotely with people in different states, then I think that that is even as exciting or maybe more exciting than being in a job where I don't have as many collaborations with folks that are, like I said, out there getting their feet wet, their boots wet, doing the conservation. I don't have a great answer for that. I think I just want to be working with people that are passionate. That's what it comes down to.
Sure. No, I mean, and in my opinion, that is a great answer, because I had plenty of people ask me, you know, like, why would you ever move to Iowa, or, you know, why would you like living in Iowa? And I mean, 9 times out of 10, it was the grad department. It was just fellow grad students who made living and surviving central Iowa winters as a South Carolina born and bred person, you know, that much more bearable and fun. And I love that answer. That's really cool. So
the people really are what, one of the reasons that I think this profession is a lot of fun. The people are a lot of fun.
Absolutely. So if there was one point or principle you could have programmed in everyone's head, maybe one lasting message from today's episode, a takeaway point for the folks listening, what do you think that would be?
You know, I talked a lot about, you know, the importance of individual variation. And I think that, you know, I could belabor that point again. And that would be certainly worthwhile to drill into people's head. But I think I'm going to switch gears a little bit and just hit on a point that I mentioned a little bit earlier, which was that, you know, fisheries management, fisheries conservation, it really does come down to a values system. And at this point in science, as managers and as biologists, we can put fish mostly anywhere we want them. It's really just comes down to what do people want out of it? And I think really having the conversation with diverse interest groups and deciding what people want out of their backyard streams and making sure that we are conserving and managing those systems in that way, I think is something that's really important. And that ultimately comes down to people getting out there and making their voice heard, because again, we can do whatever we want to with them, but we need somebody to tell us what it is that we should be doing. And in that sense, it's almost like a, I don't want to say it's like an elected position or like a political position, but it kind of is. You know, if we want to stock trout, we can stock trout. If we don't want to, we cannot. We just have to decide what it is out there. And then at the same time, when somebody doesn't agree with your value system, I think it's worth recognizing that they're not potentially wrong. They just have a different value system. And if you want to try to change that system, then it's not about telling them that they're wrong. It's about maybe presenting them with the science.
So if people want to interact with your stuff, obviously you mentioned the Trout Look, and I'll have some links in the show notes today, but are you on Twitter? Are there other ways that people can connect with you online? Or if they want to learn more about you or your work, where can they find you?
Yeah, so I do have a Twitter. The handle is just The Trout Look, which is awfully convenient because that is also how you could find my Facebook page. And then the website is www.thetroutlook.com. If you're trying to get to me directly and you want to email me, you could email me at swhite8@vt.edu.
Perfect. Well, everyone, if you want to get in contact with Shannon, just look for the links in the show notes that she just mentioned. And I'd like to thank everyone for listening to the 111th episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And Shannon, thanks so much for being a guest on today's show. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So if you'd like to get a hold of me or any of the other co-hosts, you can find me on Twitter at @BBK_95 and the podcast at @FisheriesPod. On Facebook at facebook.com/fisheriespodcast, or send us an old-fashioned email at the handle feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I really hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. Also, don't forget to head over to the Patreon page or our Teespring merch shop and support the podcast if you feel inclined. I'm Brett Kelly, and thank you for listening to this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, fisheries management comes down to a values system. We need to figure out what people want and have their voices heard.